Thank you. Hi, everybody. Just in case nobody knows who we are, my name is Portia, and this is Gwendolyn. And we are representing the Morbidistat group here. And we started off with the Fantastic Four. It was Gwen, myself, Emily, and Lucas, and we're down to only two, which makes us more fantastic because we stuck through it. And we were working under the supervision of Erdal and his magnificent TA, Fatih. All right, and that's our presentation for today. So we'd like to thank, a big thank you though to Michael, Emily, and Eileen, yes, for putting up with us throughout the last 4 weeks. Also to KITP, Richard, Paul, and Boris for having us here. It's been a great experience. And Fatih, Erdal, and Yusuf for all of your help. We couldn't figure out which one to use for you. All right, so project overview, we had two kind of big branches we were seeking out to explore. One kind of, this part was pretty known, so we're aiming to go more in depth, the dihydrofolate reductase project. So it has been previously shown that mutations that accumulate in DHFR, which is represented here, confer resistance to trimethoprim or increasing concentrations of trimethoprim. But this was done using Sanger sequencing with low resolution, and it was also shown that there was strong epistatic interactions between these substitutions. And so we set out to seek to observe high resolution tracking of this DHFR evolution by deep sequencing, and also observe interpopulation dynamics using fluorescently labeled E. coli. So these are kind of all within the same experimental setup and just kind of two different directions from there. And then the second main branch was this kind of an explored area in Erdal's lab, and it was to quantify fitness in the presence of conflicting stress factors using the TOLC. So TOLC is an intermembrane channel when combined with other proteins, forms efflux pump and E. coli. And it has many functions. So it serves as colicin, which is a toxin produced by other E. coli. Entrance and also phage entrance, which would lead in cell death. And then also it serves as efflux for antibiotics and biosalts, which would result in hopefully cell survival. So we have these conflicting stress factors, and we set up to do an experiment. We have a ton of data for all of this, but we are only going to focus in on the DHFR portion.
So this is the setup of the Morbidistat. This is a setup of the Morbidistat that we have used. So this is a cartoon to explain it. So here you have the vias where we put the culture inside, and you have a magnetic bar that is shaking the cultures. And here you have the emitter and the detector. So this is helping us to get the OD of the culture. And we always have the same volume inside. And so we want the culture to be in exponential phase. So following the OD that is calculating here, if it's below the threshold that we want, we will just add media and dilute it. If it's higher than the OD that we want, we just put the drugs. And the extra volume that we have will go to the waste. So here it will always be a constant volume. And the setup that we are using is like that. You can see different vials with different cultures. And the black circle here is the holder of the emitter and the detector. So it's here. And so we can do many different experiments at the same time.
So here we are, all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed the first week, ready to conquer the Morbidistat. Building it, and here is Santa Barbara's first Morbidistat. Actually, it's not completely set up because it wasn't running, but so we have this fabulous incubator that was built by Sebastian and Boris, which was great. And we have the Morbidistat here, the pumps up there at the top. I guess I should use the pointer. The pumps here, and so each of these vials would be connected to a media bottle, so the media would sit inside the incubator. And the pumps would flow the media up into the vials based on the OD and the threshold, or antibiotics, which was sitting outside of the incubator. And then our trash lines are here. All right, so using the Morbidistan to study DHFR evolution. So again, our first main goal is to detect this high resolution tracking of DHR evolution. So the idea was we set up in the 6 vials these bacteria and track their evolution over time in presence of trimethoprim. And so we wanted to detect using deep sequencing or identify using deep sequencing how these mutation or the alleles, the mutant alleles, fluctuate over time. And then also measuring interpopulation dynamics using fluorescent proteins or fluorescently labeled subpopulations. So again, the same population of E. coli, they're all differently, they're labeled differently with the fluorescent proteins, and so we wanted to detect how those subpopulations also fluctuate over time as well. So DHFR is a ubiquitous enzyme, so it's present in all organisms, and it's responsible for folate synthesis. And it is the target of trimethoprim, the antibiotic trimethoprim. And this figure was made by Yusuf, and it depicts a crystallized structure of DHFR, and the colored regions are actually the substitutions that we've identified, which we'll go over in a few moments.
So this is the experimental setups that we have used. So we have take 6 biological replicates, and we have put them in the different vials that you see here. And in every biological replicate, it's just the 3 isogenic strains of E. coli that express CFP, GFP, and M-cherry that Portia just explained you. And we have tracked them during 14 days, where we were just growing them and looking at the OD. And when it was over a threshold of OD, we were adding some drugs. And in the beginning, the first days, our stock concentration was 10 micrograms per ml, which is below the MIC of the wild type. And we have ended up at 2,000 micrograms per ml after 14 days, which is 1,000 times higher than the MIC of the wild type. So just to show you a little bit what the software of the Morbidistan gave us. So for every day, we can track the OD over the time. And you have many points, so every 10 seconds you can acquire the OD. And you can see that for day 7 of one of the vials, for example, the OD was just going up, up, up until it passed our threshold that was open 25. And we have had some drugs here. So it's for that it go down. And after it try to recover, it go again higher than the threshold. And you can see that it go down again. And you play this game a lot of time, a lot of days, and when the cells will become resistant, you will have something like that, where the OD is almost constant. So this is the evolution of trimethoprim, concentration over the time, so for these 14 days. So you see that the first day, it was it was almost the MIC of the wild type. Then the second day it was the same, and after when it reached just here and we just put only TMP, we just switched to a higher concentration and we play the same game until it reached a plateau and it go until 2,000 microgram per ml. And so what we have done, when we were doing the Morbidistan experiment, what we were doing is every day we were also freezing some samples, so we were making glycerol stock of it. And at the end of the experiments, we just took out this glycerol stock and put them again in overnight and look at how they were reacting with the at different trimethoprim concentration. And like that, we can find the MIC of every for every vial at every day. And so here you have the plots of every vials. And if you look, for example, if we focus on vial 3, for example.
So did you stopped at 2,000? You never went above 2,000 micrograms per mil?
The solubility of the TMP is.
Oh, I see, solubility.
Yeah.
Why 2,000 micrograms?
quite a bit.
Okay, so for the VL3, for example, if you follow in the different days, you can see that, so this is the wild type, the MIC of the wild type, and more you increase the day, more you increase your MIC. And so what we have done after that is that we have made some Illumina sequencing, and we did it for the 7th first day. So thanks to Yusuf, that helped us a lot. So we managed to send it on time, and for the Illumina sequencing, so our region that we wanted to amplify is 600 base pair, which is a little bit too long for Illumina, so we just divide it in two amplicon with an overlap region here. And we got this nice results. So Richard helped us with the analysis, meaning that he wrote all the script and just plots the data. So
presenting.
We are just presenting them. So what you can see here, for example, is the different days, so the 7 days that we had for the different vials, and you see the allele frequency for every of them. And if I focus on vial one, for example, you can see that here at day 2 a mutation occurred, and the mutation just took over the population, so all of them. At day 3, all of our population was just mutated. And the same is if you go to day 3, another mutation appear and it take over the population. And in day 4, you have two mutations that appear, and one is almost taking over the population, but a small subpopulation is having the other one. And you can look at all the different plots, and for example, in VL2, you can see that there is a mutation that appears in day 3, so it just tried, and after it just didn't keep it at all. And what is also nice to see is in VL5, you have so 2 times the same color here. It means that you have one mutation on one of the amino acids that is done by 2 different nucleotides.
How many reads do you have? How deep do you read?
Don't read.
Almost.
It was
yeah.
A lot, yeah.
200,000.
Yeah, so but you know, but somewhere between 10^-3 and 10^-4, you run into even bigger.
Well, what's the population size in the vials, roughly?
The OD of the actual.
Numbers are OD.
Yeah,
10 to the 9.
10 to the 9.
Yeah. 16
milliliters
culture.
Visual
strength.
Yeah. You know my password. See up to 3 mutations plus 1 promoter. So we also did this experiment with like 4 weeks, 5 weeks. After some time, they reach the highest resistance levels, and they don't acquire more mutations.
But at the highest level, so when you're at this 2 milligrams per mil, does it inhibit the growth at all? Or they just grow at some wild
you're still growing.
Right in the absence?
The growth rate was very similar.
Yeah.
To wild type.
It still doesn't inhibit at all.
No.
Mm-mm. All right, so here is the mutations that we observed at the end of the 7 days. So we have, here's the DHFR promoter region and the coding region. And so these mutations here that we found during this experiment was also part of the ones that were previously found in published work in our DALS lab. And then we also found these new mutations that were different, which was kind of nice to find something novel within this, within the DHFR evolution. Again.
And so just So we were talking about this Illumina sequencing, but we also have done another sequencing. So we did nanopore sequencing on the day 11. And so with the help of Josh, we made all the protocol and everything. And so what is nice with the nanopore is it's you can read, you can have longer reads. So we just needed to have one amplicon, but it's making a little bit more error. And so we have the data, but we didn't analyze them. So, but if someone wants to help.
All right, so the other thing that we did also in conjunction with this DHFR was to follow these subpopulations that are fluorescently labeled. And so I think this was something that Gwendolyn and I were most excited about, and we don't have enough time to show all of the results. But what we did really is every day that we took samples out, we took a part of that part of the samples from each of the six vials, and we diluted them down to like 2 CFU per mil, so roughly calculating out 2 CFU per mil. And we plated them out in 96 well plates, so we had like 2 plates per vial, and we let them grow for about 48 hours. And then we read the optical density and the fluorescence for all of these markers. And so one example of what the data would look like is we have our 96 well plate here, and we have if there's a signal for a GFP, it would be green, M-cherry red, CFP blue, and then if it's a mixed signal, so if it gave signal for 2 or 3 of the markers, it'd be black, and then Y is no growth. So we did this 2 plates per vial for 11 days. In fact, we have about 60 plates that we still need to read today that we don't have data for. But essentially here, I'm just going to go. Okay, so essentially here we see over the 11 days we've got, no, is it 10 days? It's about 10 days that we have the data for. We see that the CFP population pretty much takes over in these three vials, vial 1, 2, and 3. We have the frequency of the fluorescence here, and then date time on the bottom. And in every case, M-cherry kind of just goes extinct, and then GFP kind of fluctuates still. And we are interested in continuing to look at the remaining data for this assay. So really, that is just a third of everything we did. And so briefly to recap, the Morbidistat is an automated fluidic system that's used for continuous culture. And it allows us to follow the evolution of antibiotic resistance in microbes. Using deep sequencing, we were able to identify mutations that confer resistance to trimethoprim that have not been previously found. And then also we see strong selection sweeps and clonal interference between these mutations that we identified. And we were able to visualize interpopulation dynamics using the fluorescently labeled strains. And so also to end on a note, I think it was either Richard or Boris who mentioned the first day that this course tends to be competitive. And so Gwendolyn and I secretly set out to compete against all of you, against how many hours we can work in the lab. And so we roughly calculated about 200 hours that we were in lab working the past 4 weeks. And so we are the reigning champions of this competition. And this was taken late last night, so we were very tired and not all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed yet still. So that's it. Thank you for bearing with us. It was a great experience. The emojis didn't come out right. It's so sad.
When the CFP in the different vials, was that grown up from one clone that was already had the CFP in it?
Yeah. So our initial starting population, we had a 1:1:1 ratio of the E. coli expressing each fluorescent.
Yeah, no, but I guess I'm wondering whether they have the same founder, because this certainly looks, the naive interpretation from this would be that there's already some mutation conveying some growth advantage.
It may not within be that strain?
But some growth advantage in that strain that was in the when you grew the population up.
Well, from what I understand, they were all isogenic strains, and the only difference was the marker.
But strains are never isogenic because the
Well, so they were as much, right. Well, yeah. I mean, I guess that would be a question that Yusuf or Dahl could specifically answer, but that was my interpretation of our starting culture.
But I guess in wild success, you see the green one is taking over, right? Farther one maybe was the CFP one, then the green one is getting some more advantage somehow.
It can also be because of the number of wells where you have the CFP and the GFP. The number is not very high, so it's only 15% of the place that was covered with.
Yeah, we didn't get very much data points.
So it can also be due to the sampling.
Did you count this way just because you don't have a full cytometer?
You mean? Well, the plate reader, Gwendolyn wrote a code to actually detect like the signals within each well, and so if they were above a certain threshold and the well had growth in it, then we would assume that that well only had that stream.
This works.
Yeah. All right. Team paper.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Yeah. So we're team paper, and the goal of this project. This was a project started by Steven and Paul, and the goal of this project is to try to see horizontal gene transfer happening in the lab, but in the context of microbial communities, not single species, in natural microbial communities. So, of course, to study the impact of horizontal gene transfer or on these communities and their adaptations. So this is the experiment, experimental setup. So they went to a compost in Paris and took out these 10 lovely samples. And they put each of these 10 samples in the 10 bottles and let them grow in a minimal medium when the only carbon source is a piece of paper. And they set up a multi-species evolution experiment, and I'll soon describe it. But the nice thing about paper or cellulose as a carbon source is that it's a complex carbon source. So bacteria grow slowly on it, and there are many ways to degrade it and eat it. And bacteria need microbes need one another to do it. So presumably this should maintain high diversity, like diverse communities, in this experiment.
Can you remember what the nitrogen source was?
I have no idea. I think.
Ammonia. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Has ammonia in it.
Okay. Okay, so this is the evolution experiment. You have these 10 bottles with microbes and a piece of paper. And then you let it grow for 2 weeks. Microbes colonize these pieces of paper, and they grow a little bit. And then you do vortex and dilute it, and then you have two treatments. Okay, and of course in each one of them you put a fresh piece of paper in each round of each dilution. So the first treatment is it's called the vertical treatment. This is a normal evolution experiment. You let them grow for 2 weeks and dilute, and let them grow and dilute. And the second treatment, it's what's called the horizontal treatment. So this should allow for horizontal gene transfer between different bottles. So how does it work? You take each of these 10 bottles and you centrifuge it, and you take only the supernatant, what we call like the phage juice, and then you mix all of these juices together and insert them into these horizontal treatments. So we have here microbes, and we also have like phages and pieces of DNA that they can acquire into their genomes. And so the vertical the horizontal treatments continue the same thing. Every dilution, you also insert more of these phage juices. Now, so it seems that there is a strong selection in this experimental setup for horizontal gene transfer between bottles, because it's difficult to adapt to difficult for them to adapt to grow on a paper, and so you can expect that if one bottle has bacteria that grow nicely, and so there's some genes there that could that are important for eating paper, and then you expect that there will be strong selection on it, and it will increase in frequency, and we'll see it in next bottles. Okay, so this went on for a whole year, 24 rounds of dilution, and this is the kind of data that we started with in the beginning of this project. So we have two types of sequencing data. We have sequences of isolated colonies from each of the bottles, so one colony per bottle. These are assembled into full genomes, like genomes or contigs, and we also had metagenomic sequences of each of the bottles. So, and the idea is that this is the main data analysis tool that we used. The idea is that you want to, if you take a genome from a late time point, this is only the genome that we had, by the way, and you try to map to it reads from the metagenomes. So if you do it from the same bottle, if you map reads from the same bottle, this species is present there. So you have reads that will cover the genome, and you also have a lot of reads that do not match, and they will be thrown to the bin. But if you try to map reads from an early time point, and I'm only talking about the horizontal treatment right now, okay? If you're trying to map read from an early time point, then if you had an horizontal gene transfer from another bottle, then you'll have this piece of DNA that cannot be covered, that is not covered by this read from these time points, because this piece of DNA just didn't exist in this time point, and it came from outside. This is how it looks with the data. This is a nice example. You see the coverage and the position along the contig. So there's differences in the average coverage here, but you see a really sharp drop around this area, which suggests that this is a true horizontal gene transfer or insertion into this genome. And so if you did the same analysis for a vertical bottle, then you don't expect to see these gaps that are coming from insertions, because if there is a horizontal gene transfer within the bottle, then you still have the DNA somewhere in the community, and this DNA could map here, and you will see no gaps. But this is like a very simplistic story, but actually everywhere you map, you also get many of the reads that didn't originate from this genome mapping to it, because there's many conserved genes that are being mapped to, and this is really depends on how you select your threshold for deciding what to map and what to throw to the bin. But I think that for any threshold, you still get a lot of this scenario, because you have like genes that are very conserved, and so this is a problem. And another problem is that you need a really high coverage to do this analysis. This is an example where the coverage was really nice, but we also have examples when you have like very low coverage and you get many gaps just because of low coverage. So so now you'll hear about ways to say which of these gaps are really something which is a horizontal transfer, or just because of coverage. And then you'll hear more, like a more detailed analysis about specific gaps and what you find there. And you'll also see some ecological dynamics. And then I'll come back in the end and talk about a little bit of the sequencing that we did here.
Thanks, Yishai. So what I focused on during my 2 weeks working on this project was trying to answer this question of, okay, you know, in these cases which where we have low coverage, which is actually most of the early time points, how can we identify something that we think is an actual insertion event from just, you know, some area that just happened to not have reads because of poor coverage? So I made just a very simple null model of what you'd expect for these kind of uncovered regions. Here, I just assume that you basically have reads, your reads are just randomly distributed across your genome. And so given things like the coverage, the length of a read, and the length of the genome, you can work out what this distribution of these,
how are these sequencing libraries made with Illumina? Were they transposase-based libraries? Or were they choose-based libraries? They were transposase-based libraries. Okay.
Anyway, so the upshot of it is you get this exponential distribution of uncovered regions, which, you know, depends on all these parameters, and you can predict both the number of uncovered regions, these gaps, and the kind of typical length scale of these regions. And I'll show you some analysis that I've done testing this null model on metagenomes from one of the horizontal treatments mapped to a full genome from one of the late time points at that horizontal. So one of the issues with this model is that, as Ishai alluded to, coverage is extremely non-uniform across the genome. So here I've plotted the kind of a CDF of the coverage per nucleotide, and so you can see here that there's this kind of, you know, this is log-log. There's this fat tail of, you know, guys who are covered, you know, hundreds to thousands of times, and it turns out that they're significant enough that they really affect the coverage estimates, especially at the early time points where we don't have a lot of sites covered. So what I did was I came up with a couple of different ways to essentially try to, you know, like ignore these guys. And more or less what I did was I assumed that what we really had was some kind of Poisson distribution of reads, you know, at low frequencies, and then just some, you know, high frequency sites to ignore. And I had a couple of different methods of doing this filtering of reads of large coverage, and so I kind of came up with this effective coverage, if you will, of these sites on the genome. So first off, here in blue is the actual per nucleotide coverage, so the average number of times each nucleotide was hit. I mean, so that number, you know, doesn't look too bad. We have, you know, even at early time points, we have, you know, one or two per nucleotide. But when we start filtering out these reads and these kind of high frequency reads in various ways, you end up with a lot lower coverage at early time points. And so these are just two methods I used to try to do that. Yeah.
Did you stratify that for DC patterns?
I did not. Yeah, but that would be something else to do.
Yeah, and the reason that I asked about the transposase-based library is that they've mutated the transposase so that it's more promiscuous in its insertion site, but it does still have a strong insertion site bias. Mm-hmm. And something you'll often see with transposase-based libraries is a non-random dropout in coverage.
Yeah. Yeah, and so in terms of the null model, you know, you can probably tolerate like a little, you know, some, like, if coverage distances are like, say, like, you know, a factor like 50% or something, it's not going to matter too much because you get this exponential distribution, which, as I'll show in a second, like, it falls off really quickly compared to the actual distribution of these uncovered regions. So here I was more worried about these like very high coverage regions. Cool. Okay, and so now that I have some estimates for the coverage, I can try to apply my model and first just see, okay, you know, how many of these uncovered regions do I have in my data compared to these models? And so this black line here now is the number of kind of contiguous regions without any coverage in that data. So again, we're mapping these genomes from this horizontal bottle to that, you know, late time point full genome. And so early on, we have about a few thousand. It gets pretty high up here in the middle, and then it kind of comes down again. Here, I think we also had low coverage or something, so it spikes up again. But the key point is that if I, if I took my model and just plugged in the average coverage, I would get something that's completely off. That's what this blue curve is. But if I take one of my estimates where I've kind of, tossed out these regions that are really highly red, the number of gaps I predict is actually reasonably close to the model. And again, this is not me. The only fit I'm doing to the data here is taking this kind of slightly modified version of coverage. So it seemed encouraging. Now what we can do is we can actually look at the distribution of these gaps instead of just the total number and see what their lengths look like. And so here what I've done is I've plotted a CDF of the gap length distribution. So the black curve is the actual, the lengths of these length distribution of these uncovered regions. As we can see here, again, this has kind of this fat tail, right? So there's a whole bunch of guys who are pretty big. And then these dotted lines now are the CDFs predicted by various models. So this is what would happen if I'd use the average coverage, which it kind of, very underestimates. And, there's a bunch of stuff here that it thinks are gaps, which, putative insertion events, which aren't. This orange is from that kind of filtered version of the coverage. And then this green is using an exponential fit to the data. So, obviously this distribution is not actually exponential, but so I fit it just kind of on the first decade or so. And then the idea is that, these guys who are kind of, to the right of the theoretical CDF are going to be putative insertion events. Essentially, they're too large to be explained by some, simple null model. There's still, a lot of work to be done in figuring out, kind of how robust this is, how useful this is, but at least gives us a length scale. So here it says, okay, things that are longer than 10 KB are, you're not going to get by chance. And just as a sanity check, you can do this at a late time point, and you see that the null model fits pretty well. There's like maybe one region here which it would predict as being an insertion event. And then what you can then go back and do is so what these plots are is I've taken for each of these time points now, I've taken the taken the metagenome, kind of made a pile up and ran this, this analysis and asked, okay, which of these uncovered regions are longer than expected by the null model? And then here we have our, I think we had like 169 contigs just ordered by length. And the colored is where, we have reads or we don't think we have a gap, and white is where we think an insertion event might have occurred. So there's, some consistency, right? You can see actually, some of these guys are showing up in, kind of nearby time points. There's some issues like here, there's some, like a read that happened to fall in the middle of this region. So you might need to do some, further post-processing, smoothing, whatever. And occasionally you'll get things that you'll see at one time point, but not another. But overall, I think it just gives you a way of trying to, narrow your search down. Because you're searching for through all these regions of the genome, you want to try to filter out things. And again, when you look at late time points, it, everything gets filled in. So, and I think Nick will talk to us. Oh, sorry.
Can you clarify what you're mapping against?
Yeah. So there's whole gene. So basically, individuals were isolated, one from each of these bottles at one of the later time points, mm-hmm. and then whole genome sequence. So you have a whole genome sequence of, I think this is Pseudomonas,
okay.
But...
What relative abundance is that, sort of, how does the relative abundance of those isolates change throughout?
Yeah, so it starts off, so for this guy, I think he starts off pretty low. I think it was like, kind of less than 1%. At around time 10, he gets to about maybe like a couple percent or a few percent. Kind of hard to tell because you're not quite sure, which of the reads mapping here are actually from him or from, like some relative. And then it goes down again at late time points. So kind of, highest few percent, but as low as kind of, tenth of the percent.
And do you see that impacting your ability to call the gaps in terms of the coverage?
Yeah, and it's not exactly correlated. Like there's some, because there's some time points where just like you just have less metagenome reads total. So both of those are definitely issues that lead to this kind of coverage problem. Now I think Nick will talk about an orthogonal way to find these events.
All right, so yeah, I took a slightly different approach that was not based on kind of a random mapping model, and I decided to leverage the information in the paired end reads. So in this, I think it was roughly 500 base pair segments, and the reads themselves were 150 base pairs. So you would expect, on average, that they should have about 200 base pairs between paired end reads when they map. So I guess for all the discussion that follows, what I'll be doing is taking the metagenome from time point 16 or dilution step 16 vertical bottle, and I'll be mapping it onto the horizontal bottle reference genome. And I'll be trying to see if I can use the paired end reads to kind of interrogate these putative insertion events. And so, yeah, so that's what this little diagram is doing. I just kind of map the paired end reads as just singletons, and then look at the distribution of distances between those reads. And what you see is exactly what I alluded to before, is that the distribution is roughly consistent with what you would expect from the sequencing parameters. But unfortunately, I was kind of hoping for maybe a bimodal distribution or something kind of, but it's pretty smooth, so it's going to be an arbitrary cutoff on what I say is large distance and what is typical distance. So I took about 90% cutoff region. So everything in red I took as paired end reads that may be mapped across an insertion, and everything green was mapped just, you know, like you would expect. And this was used in conjunction with the coverage measurement. So then you can make a pileup of all those reads in green, and you can look at for regions. Regions with zero coverage, and also that they're flanked by paired end reads. And so those in conjunction would be a putative insertion event. So here in blue, I'm showing you kind of the coverage pileup of all those green paired end reads. And then in orange, what I did was every time you hit a paired end read in the red region, you just add one. And then when you hit its conjugate pair, you subtract one. So this is kind of a cumulative, just to show that these actually line up quite well. So you would expect naively that that should be an insertion. And then what I did was I went to the reference genome from the horizontal bottle at time point 16. I took all these regions, and I just cut them out. And I was going to look for reads that actually spanned this junction. So using this kind of methodology, I found 103 kind of putative insertion we thought could be. So basically the idea is, if this actually was an insertion event, there should be reads that map across this region. So then I kept track of where I made these cuts, and I looked at the coverage of the mapping on these new kind of cut reference genomes. And so these are the distributions of coverages. So in blue is basically the coverage along these new kind of cut reference genomes, and in orange are the subselected sites of these cuts. And so maybe you could convince yourself, oh, this tail kind of could be real insertion events. But, you know, luckily Mr. Kolmogorov tells us a nice way to ask if these distributions are sampled from the same distribution. And you get a p-value of 0.3. So there's a 30% probability that these are actually pulled from the same distribution. So what I can say is that there's little statistical significance here to call gaps, at least with the data that we have, gaps as in putative insertion events. So what could you do? You could either increase your sequencing throughput, use HiSeq and get 100 times more data, or you could really say, I believe this tail, and you go PCR those junctions. Those are probably the two ways you should do it. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So after we use this statistical method to find good candidates, it's time to get down the rabbit hole and try to really look at one of those putative insertion position. We will only stay at the entrance though, because this hole runs deep and we have only so much time. So we will look at one of the contigs, the contig 23 from the metagenome, from the genome that was isolated from time 16 bottle H5. And this is This config maps against all of the metagenome. This is only a small fraction of the awe-inspiring amount of data we managed to get out of this experiment, because we have maybe 1,000 times more of those images. And this is why we need a statistical approach to really find good candidates before going deeper. So here you can see in this region what seems to be a gap. And when we superimpose the attritional model on this to find which region are less covered than from the null model, we see that so here you have all the metagenomes. Each line is a metagenome, and there is a color and there is a mapping at 95% identity. And for some of the metagenome, we are not the null model does not predict that this apparent gap is surprising because the coverage is so poor. So it's a strong indication to try to go deeper in the sequencing. In some of them, so clearly here, this sequence was present in the bottle, and this is the bottle from which the cell were isolated, which is a good thing. And one of the original objectives was to try to find compelling arguments to say that this actual sequence, which is here, comes from another bottle. And I am yet to find a really good example which makes sense according to the experimental setup, because here you can see that this sequence is also found in one of the vertical bottle and not in any other horizontal. So it might be an insertion event that is older than the beginning of the experiment. But we have plenty of other candidates to look at, and I took this one because we did a lot of stuff on it in order to give you a flavor of what kind of analysis we can do out of this data. So if we look at this config, this is the coverage of the vertical bottle over the horizontal bottle at the same time 16, and we start by looking at the GC content, and we see that there is quite a drop. Pseudomonas is GC rich, and this region seems to be odd, so it might be the sign of an insertion event, but it also might explain part of the drop in coverage, even though this drop in GC content do not prevent the fact that this gap, this region is well covered when you map the metagenome against the genome from the same bottle. So this is an argument to say that it's not only the GC bias. And then when you look in more details at the gap region, you can do several kind of analysis. So the pair ends reads that Nick talked about, that you can see on both sides. The protein annotation, so you see that you have some porins and other enzymes that are on this region. And this region is flanked by two tRNAs, which is also an argument to say that this is a laterally transferred region, because what happened is that if you have a circular piece of DNA bearing a tRNA, it can align on the genome, and then you have a crossing over, and you will end up with the inserted region with two tRNA flanking it. So here you have one tRNA here and one other here, and the idea was to look at the reads that map this exact region. So here they are. You have a few reads that map this exact region each time. So each pileup is a read, and all those reads mapped at three points in the config. So these are the reads that map at several places in the same config. So in green, in orange, and in blue, you see that this small sequence was repeated three times across this config. So it's again an argument to say that it's an insertion point, because we have the junction on one side at least in green, and on the other side it's slightly less convincing, because what you see is that you can take the sequence from the reads and run it another software in order to predict tRNAs, and the red region that you have here is the predicted tRNA. So on the green side here, we have the tRNA plus a little bit of the rest of the sequence. Oops, sorry. But on the other side, it's not that clear yet. So we need to maybe sequence deeper in order to find the proper junction, which read that really cover the insertion, the putative insertion points.
All right, so we've taken up a lot of time already. But instead of gaps, I wanted to sort of look at the big picture. And so we took all the metagenomes, ran them through MGRAS, and sort of just asked who's there. And I'm just going to skip this. The idea that I wanted to look at was the stuff that's there in the beginning and abundant at the beginning, what happens to that, and the stuff that's abundant at the end, where does it come from? And so that's what it did here. So in red, those are the ones that are abundant initially. I took the 20 most abundant ones, and final are the 20 most abundant at the end, and black are the ones that are present in both. And I'm sure you could stare at this for a long time. I'm just going to run you through the bottles, and there's just going to be one message, which is this is not just noisy. This is completely messy, I think. So either the 16S data is really bad, and so we tried running it, or we did run it through Diamond and Megan, but apparently the runs are still not done, so we didn't have a full table of things to look at. So maybe that would give you better information, but maybe this also just means that there's just a ton of stuff going on. And you don't really know what it could be. If you correlate all the things against each other, it's actually not completely crazy, which is sort of surprising. So this is the initial frequency versus the final frequency for all the bottles and all the abundances. And the correlation is actually pretty okay. I mean, I'm not saying this is perfectly correlated, but it's not as crazy as it could be. So there's some structure to this chaos.
On the log or on the linear?
On the linear, yeah. So, but no, that's right. These few points dominate it, but still, you know, it could be all over the place.
Did you do an experiment?
Hmm?
Do you get like a rank correlation?
I don't remember whether this is the R squared or the actual correlation coefficient. Yeah, but both are sort of not zero, so. That was like the main point. Is it zero or not? Yeah.
It's a theorem, but not data points on zero.
That's true. All right, somebody else talk about this? We can also skip it. I'll just do it briefly. Metabolism was surprisingly constant over all our populations, and probably the most hits was this full nitrogen cycle of intake with nitrogen. This was surprising because particularly this pathway of they were supplying ammonia, but this whole pathway was very well represented. So there seems to be constant nitrogen being flown through this community in all bottles. Okay.
Okay, hi again. And so I guess you saw some nice analysis on this stuff and some pretty strong evidence that some of these gaps really represent horizontal gene transfer or insertion from another bottle. But I guess the strongest evidence would be to find two genomes of the same bug, one from an initial time point and one from a late time point. And then you see them matching really nicely to one another, except for these few insertions or also deletion events. And then you can say for sure that you had DNA insertion. So this is we wanted to take like a small step towards this goal, and we wanted to find genomes from that match one another from two time points. So the first goal was to go to one bottle and look for trying to sequence many isolates and find this match. Long story short, we only ended up sequencing 8 isolates and we didn't find a match. Then we thought about like maybe quicker way to do this, more efficiently. We thought of trying to sequence metagenomes. And with nanopore, we might be able to assemble full genomes. And then again, we might have matches from early and late time points. But so we tried 2 times to sequence metagenomes with the nanopore, and 2 times it failed. Flow cell was not okay. But I want to leave you with hope. So another thing that was going on here is that Stephen was looking at all of the genomes that we already had from late time points and looking at the RecA gene there, which is very conserved. And now he designed primers to go to hunt for these exact genomes in the early time point, so with a colony PCR of isolate. So so this is one future plan. Another is, of course, to sequence much deeper, because this would be really improve the analysis. And another goal is to do some functional analysis. They have a way to measure cellulose degradation, and then this could also see some stuff. And so that's it. We wanted to thank everybody in KITP, in the lab, and Paul, Stephen, and Guillaume. And yeah, thank you all.
All right. So we're coming to our last presentation by Team Pink.